Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In early February, city officials in Columbus announced a $68 million tax break for developers in Easton in exchange for less than $6 million to be spent on the Linden neighborhood. The deal has raised eyebrows. Why so much for so little? We wanted to talk about what led to the deal, what it involves, and the philosophy behind such economic development strategies. We invited representatives from the City of Columbus, the Georgetown Company, which has developed Easton Town Center, and Columbus City Schools to join us for the conversation. All declined our invitation. Joining us now by phone is Columbus Dispatch City Hall reporter Rick Ruan. Welcome, Rick.
Thanks for having me.
You broke the story on January 31st. The city announced it officially 2 days later. What does this deal do?
Well, essentially, this boils down to a residential property tax abatement. So anything that Georgetown builds that people can live in on the Easton property will be abated at 100% from its property taxes for 10 years. And that exists essentially in perpetuity. So if they build it this year, then it's 10 years from the time that it's built. If they wait 5 years from now and they build something else on the Easton property, it'll be abated for 10 years. As you explained, in exchange for that, Georgetown is going to give the city about $5.75 million to use in Linden for redevelopment efforts there. They also have to create 250 full-time non-retail jobs at Easton by the end of 2021, and that has to be boosted up to 500 jobs by the end of 2028. If they don't do that, they face a $100,000 a year penalty.
But if you say it goes on in perpetuity, couldn't they wait until 2020 to start building?
Yeah, they could, but indications have been that they intend to start building here in the spring.
Exactly. How did the city negotiate this deal? How does that work?
Well, as I understand it, Georgetown came to the city and they had this idea, and the city essentially under Mayor Ginther has been looking for ways to redevelop Linden. So the city sees this as an opportunity to get money up front that they can use in one of their most struggling neighborhoods. And they ultimately saw it as a win for that opportunity. Now, Georgetown had to go out and make some things happen so that the mechanics of this could work out. They had to get a state law changed so that the money that they were providing didn't have to be used necessarily in the Easton area, which is traditionally how a tax increment financing district works. The tax dollars go into the TIF, and then it's used to pay for infrastructure upgrades in the area where the development is occurring. In this case, they wanted to be able to use that money elsewhere, so they were able to create what's called a remote TIF, but state law had to be changed in order to accommodate that.
What else does that state law change affect? The school's input on this, right?
I don't know that the state law change affected the school's input on it. The bottom line for the school's input is that because this is considered residential development, state law says that the school district doesn't have to approve it. It would be different if it were commercial development, but because it's residential development, that's the nuance there and why the schools don't necessarily get a say here.
We're talking about the $68 million tax abatement for Georgetown Company. That's the developer of Easton Town Center. My guest is Rick Ruan. He's City Hall reporter for the Columbus Dispatch and covered this when it broke back in late January. We're going to be talking to people about the pros and cons of such deals coming up later in the program. Now, how is the city school board responded? Because we're talking about residential construction. That means children who need to be educated.
I can't speak so much to, you know, how the school board has reacted. You know, we have another reporter who covers the school board. Essentially, what he has reported in the paper is that, you know, it's becoming a campaign issue. There are seats open on the school board this year that you have incumbents running for and you have challengers running for, and how they respond to tax abatements is going to be an issue in that election.
You said, as you said, that about $5.75 million is going to be channeled to Linden development. But some of that money has to be paid back to the developers over time, right?
Correct. So you have $5.75 million that Georgetown is ultimately going to pay the city. However, $4.25 million of that is going to be repaid to the developer by the tax increment financing district. So when they start paying taxes into the TIF, they're going to get some of that money back from the TIF. Now, that's money that traditionally, as I said before, would go to infrastructure upgrades in the area around the TIF. But in this case, the TIF is going to repay Georgetown a portion of that $5.75 million that Georgetown is giving to the city for redevelopment in Linden. Now, the expectation that I have been told is that that TIF would generate more than that $4.25 million. So there would still be money in it to make infrastructure upgrades in that area, but it's unclear how much greater than the $4.25 million it's going to be. And that would be repaid over 30 years. So it's not like they get it back at, you know, 5 years from now.
At today's rates.
Yeah.
Also, you know, you mentioned that because it's a residential property tax abatement, schools aren't consulted. They're not part of the deal-making process. But the abatement does call for the creation of 250 jobs, retail jobs. How does Georgetown, how do they take responsibility for jobs created? How do they make that connection? Could it be any jobs, just 250 jobs by 2021 and, 500 by 2028? And any job that goes up that's non-retail, they can take credit for?
Essentially, they have to be full-time non-retail jobs. Mm-hmm. Now, the expectation is that Georgetown wants to do this residential development because they're trying to create an urban center out in the suburbs. So there's not, a lot of housing options right there at East End. And they say that there's great demand from potential employers to have that housing to be able to attract certain employees. They're looking to attract millennials and empty nesters who would live at East End and work, not necessarily at the mall, but East End is also a sprawling multi-use development. Mm-hmm. That has several business park areas around there. You've got Alliance Data Systems there. You've got several large employers up there. Those are the kind of jobs that they're talking about when they're talking about these 250 and 500 jobs. When the mayor announced this officially a few days after I initially reported it, mm-hmm. he said that the average salary up there is in the $60,000 range.
Right. So looks like things are going good for Georgetown. How did the city justify giving them a $68 million property tax break?
Well, I think it's the way that they see it is they got something in return here. They got almost $6 million for Linden and continued efforts there. And they're ultimately going to create 500 jobs out there. I think that's how the city looks at it, that they didn't necessarily just give them $68 million. They got something in return.
Who's going to decide how the money is spent in Linden?
The bottom line is the city will decide how the money is spent in Linden. But the mayor has said that they're going to have a public process for that. It's supposed to kick off early next month with a big event in Linden where they're going to be seeking community input on how the money should be spent. But when the rubber meets the road, it'll be the city making the ultimate decision.
Now, I know you didn't report on the school part of it, but how much money was foregone for school coffers in this deal? Do you know?
Well, it's the total tax break, as you said, is $68 million over 37 years. About $46 million of that is school money.
And you're saying it's become a campaign issue for schools. Bill Bush, of course, your colleague at the Dispatch, has reported on that.
Yes.
But the schools weren't even involved in it, right, in this negotiation?
They weren't involved in the negotiation. The city certainly let them know what was going to be happening, but they did not. They didn't have any power to make this deal change if they wanted it to. I don't know that anybody at Columbus Schools wanted the deal to be different than the way it turned out. But even if they did, they didn't have power to influence that deal.
Construction, as you mentioned earlier, it's supposed to start in the spring. What's the developer, that's New York-based Georgetown company, going to build? Mm-hmm. A lot of multi-unit housing, that kind of a thing?
Yeah, I mean, they've left it pretty open-ended, but I think the expectation is that these will be rental units. You'll see maybe apartments pop up there. I think that'll be the initial phase, is you'll see a bunch of apartments pop up pretty soon.
And you said it's become an issue, a campaign issue when it comes to school board. What about a campaign issue when it comes to city council? Any noise on that score?
Sure. I mean, it's going to be a campaign issue in the council race as well. We have three seats that are up for election on council this year, and there are nine candidates who are campaigning for the primary there. Six of them will move on to the general election. And property tax abatements, including this one, are going to be a part of that race. You're going to have candidates who don't agree with the city's philosophy on giving property tax abatements. This was certainly a large abatement and unusual, and that you have money that's being funneled to Linden in this case. But the city has been giving property tax abatements for years.
Mm-hmm. And just to be clear, the city council has approved this. This is a done deal now.
Yeah, there's one piece of legislation that's still lingering out there from the city perspective. They have to essentially set the boundaries for where the property tax abatement is going to cover. Mm-hmm. Like I said before, East End is kind of a sprawling development. It's not just the center mall that you would typically think of with East End. That map is essentially done. It just needs to be approved by city council.
Rick Ruan, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
No problem, man.
Rick Ruan is a City Hall reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. We're going to continue our conversation about the wisdom of these kinds of deals, who benefits, who doesn't, when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Easton Town Center, the developer of the Easton Town Center, I should say, is expected to get a $68 million tax break over a 10-year period to build new housing around the booming shopping complex. In exchange, the Linden neighborhood will get less than $6 million, much of which is to be repaid to the Easton developer over time. And city schools were neither consulted in the deal-making, nor will they share in the expected increase in income tax revenue for the city. The schools, however, will lose out on about $46 million in foregone property taxes. Coming up, we're going to hear from a proponent of such deals as important tools for economic development. Joining us now by phone is Executive Director of Good Jobs First, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that tracks public subsidies to corporations, Greg Leroy. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Great to be with you, Ann.
Also with us here in the studio, regional urban economist at Ohio State University, Mark Partridge. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you, Ann.
Let's talk about just the title of your organization, Greg Leroy, Good Jobs First. This deal is bringing in as many as 500 jobs by the end of 2028, if all goes well. That sounds pretty good. What do you make of it?
Well, but I'm glad you teased out the sort of indirect connection between the developer creating an office park versus residential development versus actual job creation. So it sounds like the developer is going to be able to take credit for the activities of its tenants, if I understand correctly, which is a very indirect way. That's not the way normal accountability rules are written into incentive deals.
Right. It's usually I'm a developer, I'm going to build an office building, and this many people are going to come to work there. Not I'm going to build housing, and that's going to attract that many jobs.
Correct. And I mean, the other thing is, everything I read about this deal suggests that it's a windfall because the people want to live closer to work. That's a national trend, back to the city movement. Columbus has had continuous population growth all these times. This is a magnet project, it sounds like. I'm struck by the lack of any set-asides for more affordable housing either.
For our listeners, as a reminder, we did invite the city of Columbus. We invited Easton Town Center's developer, the Georgetown Company. We invited the Columbus Region, that's the group behind the 2020 Master Plan for Central Ohio, and Columbus City Schools to join us on today's program. All four declined our invitation. The developer has said that businesses wanted more nearby residential options for employees. That makes sense, Mark Partridge. Proponents have called it a win-win because in the long run, the city will have revenues, and it wouldn't if the development was never built. As far as you look at Easton Town Center and how it's doing, what is your how do you summarize what's going on here?
Well, thank you, Ann. Typically, economists are very critical of these kinds of schemes. You'll hear conservatives cry crony capitalism and more liberals cry, you know, corporate welfare. And economists will say you're both right. So I think in asking the question you did, it's what would have happened without the subsidy? And as was pointed out, the region's growing. We would have had apartment buildings built throughout the metropolitan area. We would have had housing built throughout the metropolitan area. The difference is that in that case, they would have been collecting property taxes for the school and for the city, and those monies could have been used for Linden or anything else. But now what's really happened is the question is where that's going to take place. It's now going to take place near Easton, where there's going to be a big tax abatement, and we're going to create no new net jobs. They're going to be created anyway, but we're going to lose all these tax revenues.
What arguments are made, I guess, to put on another jacket here and say, what arguments are made to city officials? Why do they think this is a good idea?
Well, before I talk about maybe perhaps some underlying motives, the typical response on these, and this is not just a Columbus thing, this is a national issue.
Right.
Or political, it's not a party, but it's both parties. But they typically, the argument is that this is some sort of development that wouldn't happen unless we kick in some money, and without this money, we're not going to get all these great things. Without realizing that if the region's growing, apartments are going to be built and housing's going to be built anyway.
Right. So, Good Jobs First surveys current trends in state and local governments offering tax breaks and other incentives for business locations. Greg Leroy, what is the trend? I mean, is this still happening in other cities like Columbus, where growth is on the horizon no matter what?
It's a mix, to be honest with you.
Okay.
Some places are playing a smarter poker game and realizing and bargaining more astutely based on sort of their hard market analysis. If you have high quality of life, if you already have job growth, if you have a low vacancy rate like Columbus does and so on, you're in the catbird seat. You can bargain a harder deal and you may not have to give up any concessions to a developer to attract deals. There is a dogma out there that you have to do it. You have to look business friendly, and some people are still very stuck in that dogma. But it's more common in harder hit places in your state, like Cleveland, that's still declining, or other places where they feel like they need to stimulate the market because the market's not performing as well as it is in Columbus.
What is a region like Columbus competing against? Is it competing against the next nice big city in Columbus, or what, Greg Leroy?
Well, certainly competing with some jurisdictions in the area, right? Some companies, yeah, the meaningful unit of competition is the labor market, the metro area. So if a company were looking to bring in jobs from outside the region, they could look at the city itself versus the suburbs, because they would still have access to the same labor market and amenities and infrastructure systems. And then the next ring out would be other metro areas that would bring the same, you know, skill set and linkages and business climate advantages that Columbus might have. You have a long history, actually, in Dayton, the metro area of Dayton, of cooperation among both the urban center and suburban jurisdictions, a system that's been in place for more than 20 years and highly successful.
How does that work?
Well, it basically says that we're not going to pay companies just to move around within the metro area. We will talk to each other if a company tries to put us in the prisoner's dilemma, and where we would normally be quiet and not talk to each other, we've agreed to talk to each other, essentially. It's called the EDGE program, and like I say, it's been around. It was initiated by Montgomery County, and it now actually exceeds the borders of that county.
And, Mark Partridge, that's not necessarily the case here, since Georgetown Company isn't directly responsible for bringing the jobs in. They don't have any connection to where the jobs will come from. It could come from Reynoldsburg or Dublin.
Oh, exactly. If you're building an office park, certainly those jobs are going to be coming from other office parks that would have existed. So in this case, they're coming from office parks that were paying property taxes to now one that's going to be abated. So again, no jobs. We're just shifting around where the jobs are. Nothing's being created. We're just reducing public finances in the region.
And also, Greg LeRoy, one of the deals I think it was a state law that passed only maybe 10 or 15 years ago that requires school boards to be involved in negotiations on tax abatements, property tax abatements, when they involve corporate or commercial construction, but not residential. And I mean, knowing that residential is what increases the cost to the district and corporate is what increases the bottom line for districts, I'm kind of fascinated by that. And at the time, I think I might even been covering the General Assembly and didn't make that necessarily that distinction. What do you make of it? The school district was completely shut out of this.
It's all too common, actually. In fact, we published a study on this very subject 14 years ago in which we profiled the debate in Ohio at that time. Typically, in most states, effectively, school boards are really shoved out of the process, even though they are the biggest losers. In your state, like many in the Midwest, local property taxes are still a disproportionately large source of school revenue, yet and still school boards basically suffer kind of an intergovernmental free lunch by cities or counties when they create TIF districts or abatements or enterprise zones.
Right. TIF districts and enterprise zones, Mark Partridge, they bypass that rule that was established in the General Assembly.
I'm not sure exactly that one.
Okay. So what school districts, I mean, they're saying this is a campaign issue now in the school district or the school board elections, Mark Partridge, but I don't see why it would be. They were cut out.
Well, I mean, I could see in the sense that there's a lot of frustration from the schools that they were cut out. They're still going to have to educate the children, but they're not going to have the revenue to do that. And, you know, but I think in the broader sense that now somebody's going to have to pay those taxes. That means the taxes have to go up on the rest of us or services are going to be cut. And so that means in general, the region's going to be less competitive because somebody's going to have to pay for this. So it's not like something out of the blue was created. This is something that somebody's going to have to pay. And it is going to make the region less competitive.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about deals like the one cut with Georgetown, the Georgetown company that's a New York-based development company that developed Easton Town Center and now has cut a $68 million deal with the city of Columbus. It's a tax abatement, 10-year tax abatement, 100% tax abatement that pretty much cut out the school district and cost the school district a foregone $46 million. If you have a question or comment about these kinds of deals, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Greg LeRoy, Good Jobs First surveys current trends, as I mentioned earlier. How do you measure the success of such a strategy?
Well, in many ways you can't, because at the end of the day, the company's decision-making process remains a black box. That's sort of a big structural problem with the way economic development has evolved in this country over decades, really. So our solution is really to more narrowly construct the eligibility rules for programs so that you can be sure you're really addressing what the economists would call a market imperfection. That is, if you're trying to bring a grocery store to a food desert, or if you have an affordability housing crisis and you need a greater share of affordable rental units, and you narrowly write the rules as a scalpel to address a narrow, specific issue. We think that's the only way to really avoid these windfall problems.
You said as the way this process has developed in the United States, do other countries have different cultures of economic development strategy?
Yes. Yes, indeed. Including the countries that signed the Treaty of Rome, creating the European Union, have a much smarter and higher degree of cooperation and stinginess, if you will, than do the 50 states of the United States. We're the Wild West compared to Europe.
Well, how so? I mean, can you give me an example?
Sure. So in Europe, there's a unified definition for what's a distressed area, and only in truly distressed areas can you get the maximum tax breaks. And the value of the tax breaks are capped. We have many deals in the United States that exceed the European caps, called aid intensity rules. And there's also a system basically which encourages companies to sort of tell on each other, to tattle on each other. And there's a whole dispute, an arbitration process for companies trying to deny each other incentives. Imagine that happening here in this country.
Instead of trying to get around each other by getting the incentives.
Right.
Email from Mike asks, why are neighborhoods like Italian Village in the Short North that have been nearly completely redeveloped still tax abated? There are new houses in Italian Village selling for well over $500,000 that have 10 or 15 year tax abatements. It doesn't seem like that neighborhood still needs the incentive, and the city is losing out on a ton of tax income. Thoughts? Mark Partridge, you're familiar with the area we're talking about. What about that?
Well,
I know you can't speak for the city. And by the way, listeners, we asked the city to come. We asked Georgetown Company to come. We asked other entities, including the Columbus City Schools, to join us, and all of them declined our invitation.
Well, I think the city or any government would have responded that we would not have gotten this redevelopment without these tax
in the past.
Right. However, I think one of the things, though, kind of one of the underlying motives, and this would be in any city. This is, you know, Donald mm-hmm. Trump spoke about this, and you know, in his own personal experience, is that if you look at any mayoral election or council election, typically the largest contributor are real estate developers, and they're doing that for access and perhaps sweetheart deals and so forth. So there's reasons why the politicians are relatively friendly to this group.
Yeah, Greg LeRae.
Yeah, I guess the other point I would make is this issue of homes that are selling for $500,000 that still have property tax abatements running on them. This is another recurring structural problem we see with cities where they aren't able to sort of take their foot off the gas pedal. And we think that's kind of nuts. The same problem adheres here in the District of Columbia where I work, where we've got super wealthy neighborhoods and very distressed neighborhoods, but the same rules apply for abatements for new home, multifamily home construction. Whereas in the wealthy neighborhoods, that shouldn't be true. And we have such sophisticated tools now. They're such very sophisticated, you know, GIS and micro planning tools to allow us to calibrate the degree of incentivized tax breaks based on the condition of the neighborhood and the trajectory and whether or not the invisible hand is returning and working its wonders, so to speak. We should save our money and calibrate our incentives carefully based on where the neighborhood really is at now.
And if I may, I'll just point out that one of the problems of this is that what we're actually raising is that typically when these things first started going way back, why did we start doing these tax abatements? To help, you know, struggling distressed neighborhoods. And what we've actually gotten is it's typically redeveloped very nice neighborhoods and it's doing exactly the opposite of what they were originally intended to do.
Well, this isn't even redevelopment. This is these are cornfields or, you know, grassy knolls at this point. They're not redeveloping anything. And the tax abatement occurs during the first 10 years after the structure is built, which is probably with a new structure. It's the nadir of its value. Is that right, Greg LeRae?
Well, it would depend upon the trajectory of the neighborhood.
True.
It could be, but it might not be either. There might be a handsome area that fetches a good price to begin with, and then
increases.
Tapers off.
Yeah, yeah. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi. I just was curious. You keep referring to this as a loss of revenue.
Well, the foregone revenue, right?
Right, but I mean, the money wouldn't be there if not for the construction, right? So it's not loss of revenue. And the other point is that you're bringing in people that are going to be paying, you know, they may not be paying property tax, but they're certainly going to be paying income tax and increasing the value of the area. So I guess I just don't see how this tax abatement is necessarily an awful thing.
So this goes to the black box problem. We don't know. There's no way to know because the developer is never going to be required to sign at risk of perjury that they wouldn't build the housing absent the tax abatement. And that's true in all these projects.
So in a – yeah, go ahead. Mark Partridge?
Well, I mean, going back to the listener's question, in the region, if we didn't have this tax abatement, the region's growing. It's creating jobs. I mean, this is nothing in this abatement's changing the trajectory of how many jobs is going to be created in the region. There would have been housing built. It would have been built all over the metropolitan area.
Because there's a demand for it.
Right. Not just concentrated in this one spot. And so there is tax revenue that's being lost. The revenue that would have been created from that housing that wouldn't have been abated if they hadn't have done this deal.
It's the distressed areas. Let's go back to that issue of when these deals first came out, they were intended for distressed areas where there wouldn't otherwise be construction of residential housing or new businesses and that sort of thing. Right, Greg?
That's correct. And it's the name of one of our early studies called Straying from Good Intentions, where programs often start out kind of narrowly structured the way I recommended, but then over time they get loosened and deregulated. And community reinvestment areas are an example of that in Ohio.
And the issue that Fred in Columbus brought up, that, hey, you know, they said that the average wage or something like that is going to be around $60,000 a year, a decent wage. There's going to be income taxes, but schools don't benefit from income taxes by and large. They benefit from property taxes, that kind of a thing, right?
Right. And obviously the other issue, salient issue for the school district here is that based on the press reports I've seen, a million square feet of new residential space is going to come online. If the average rental unit is roughly 1,100 feet, that's give or take about 900 new households. Some of them will be baby boomers and empty nesters, but some of them are going to be millennials and they're going to have kids. And then you got to educate them. So the school district is going to incur costs while not getting the revenue.
And regarding the 500 jobs, again, it's the same kind of thing. They would have been they were going to be created somewhere in the metropolitan
and
area.
Georgetown Company certainly isn't creating them.
Right, right. And they're just trying to Georgetown just trying to lure them to their office park. And so we lose out we didn't create anything. We just shift where it is.
And Georgetown says that they're doing this because potential tenants, commercial tenants, have said the people that they want working for them or that want to work for them don't want to live out in a sprawling suburb. They want sort of this urban sort of a thing. Again, they don't have to write an affidavit to that effect, right, Greg Leroy? They just say it.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, the Back to the City movement is real. There's a lot of untapped demand for mixed-use, walkable, multifamily settings close to work like that. There's, you know, by some polling, you know, 2 out of 5 new homeowners want that kind of situation or new household seekers.
So we did have an email from Elisa who asks a question that I don't know either of you can answer because you weren't in on the negotiations, but asks of the 5 non-retail jobs to be created as a result of this initiative. Number one, they're not going to be created as a result. That's just an expectation. She asks, is there any type of stipulation that some of these jobs be filled by residents of the Linden community? That's another thing. There's no actual connection, Mark Partridge, between Easton and Linden.
That's a great question. That's one of my concerns with these typical developments, that they're often there's some sort of component that we're going to help a distressed neighborhood. But to actually help the distressed neighborhood, help those residents, you have to provide them jobs. And often those residents in distressed neighborhoods are actually hurt in the sense that rents start being bid up and so forth. And they're actually being pushed out from all of this. So the residents that are supposedly going to be helped are actually being hurt.
Hmm. Yeah, the mechanism that could ameliorate that is called a community benefit agreement. We started publishing about those a long, long time ago, where you could say we're going to create an intentional hiring pipeline where we give first preference to people from Linden to qualify for some of the new jobs. We're going to make some affordable housing set-asides. We may need some environmental easements to adjust for traffic pattern changes. We may need a public health center or a child daycare center to facilitate working parents holding jobs there. You could do lots of things if you had a community benefits agreement.
And you could do in a community benefits agreement, you can make promises that they'll be a favor, they will favor residents of Linden, for example, in these jobs?
Yes, they're legally binding agreements between community groups and developers, which are then appended to the redevelopment agreement between the developer and the city.
We're going to continue our conversation. That's Greg LeRoy. He's executive director of Good Jobs First. It's a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that tracks public subsidies to corporations. Also with us, Mark Partridge. He's a regional urban economist at Ohio State University. Coming up, we're going to hear from the economic development director for the city of Delaware, Sean Hughes. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the pros and cons of tax breaks for developers in the wake of the recently announced plan for a $68 million tax break over property tax break over 10 years for the developer of Easton Town Center. In exchange, the Linden neighborhood in Columbus will get about $5.75 million, much of which is to be repaid to the Easton developer over time. We hear about tax abatements all the time, not surprisingly, in fast-growing Delaware County and the city of Delaware. Still with us is OSU regional urban economist Mark Partridge, joining us by phone. Also with us still is Greg LeRoy. He's executive director of Good Jobs First, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that tracks public subsidies to corporations. And joining us as well by phone now is Sean Hughes. He's economic development director for the city of Delaware. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having me today.
You know, I lived in Delaware Township for about 6 years, and for a long time, it was Delaware County that was fast-growing, but the city of Delaware, not so much. They had the struggles. They had sort of those old infrastructure issues that cities even like Columbus grapple with.
Yes. I mean, I think we're obviously at the mid to northern tip of what was a high growth area mm-hmm. for a long time, and it took a lot of reinvestment in our infrastructure as well as our community in general and quality of life issues and so on and so forth and schools to really allow us to take advantage of that growth that you're seeing in southern Delaware County.
Mm-hmm. Which is Olentangy City Schools, not Delaware City Schools.
Actually, most of our city, we do serve two school districts within the city limits. Primarily, it's Delaware City School District and then our south eastern portion of the city. And actually, some of the southwestern portion fall within Olentangy.
Okay. Do you keep track of how many tax abatements are going out at any given time in Delaware?
Yes, absolutely. As required by the Higher Revised Code, we each year have to, with the schools and with the county, go through a tax incentive review process. And actually, it's funny because today is that day for us. this is a very timely conversation. So, right now on the books, we have about 15 total active tax abatements that are going on right now. Those are commercial industrial tax abatements, and then we have another several abatements that are on the redevelopment side for housing. I heard the earlier conversation. Our residential abatements are only for distressed properties on the residential side.
You know, Greg LeRoy, I wanted to ask you, wrote in January that the true costs of these deals are going to be released because the governmental accounting standards boards will make it so. How does that agency do that? An agency most have never heard of do that.
So, actually, despite its name, it's not a government agency.
Oh, okay.
It's just a professional standard-setting organization created by the big associations of public officials more than 30 years ago, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board. And it sets forth what are called generally accepted accounting principles, and it updates them periodically by issuing statements, which are really amendments to GAAP, G-A-A-P. Mm-hmm. And the latest statement, 77, on tax abatement disclosures is now in effect, and for calendar 2016 and fiscal 17 financial reports that are beginning to come out. In fact, the city of Columbus will be one of the first big cities in the United States to come out, probably third week of April. For the first time, cities, counties, school districts will have to report how much revenue they lose to their tax abatement programs.
Does this sound familiar, Sean Hughes?
Yes, this is actually the first year that we are required to submit our GASB 77 report. You know, and it's interesting because we've been collecting this information for years as part of our tax incentive review process. Really, for us, it's actually just a reformatting the information to follow the guidelines. But again, this information's always been collected. It's always been on the state's website. I as John Q. Citizen, could always go to the state's website and pull down any tax information, abatement information that I'd like to see in regards to any community, and see that same information. This is just a different way of seeing it.
And I want to applaud that and support that. In fact, Ohio was the very first state to put such information online in 1999.
Yes.
And it's due to a state senator named Chuck Horn from Dayton who advocated for that at the state capitol.
Sean, the Easton deal gives the developer 100% tax abatement right off the bat. As soon as construction begins, the tax abatement, as soon as the buildings are built, the tax abatement kicks in. You said that potential for an abatement to grow allows the city to remain competitive. You said that in terms of a previous deal cut in Delaware City, that it allows the city to remain competitive with deals offered by other municipalities. In other words, you start out at, say, 50%, and then you can grow it if competition comes into play. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Actually, we are finalizing what's called an economic development incentive policy right now with our school district partners as well as the county that we've really actually been using in theory for the last 4 years. I got here with the city in 2013. And what it is it actually kind of takes more of a formulaic approach, much to what Jobs Ohio is currently using for statewide incentives.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows us to say, you know, one, this company fits within our target industries parameters. These are the types of jobs that we need for our current labor force. We had a real problem with the city of Delaware where 80% of our labor force, and actually the statistic is the same for the county, 80% of our labor force were leaving the community for work every day.
Hmm.
And we knew exactly what those people were doing, so we had to redirect our job creation efforts to fulfill those job needs instead of just trying to create any job known to man.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first piece of information we look at is, are these the types of jobs that our current labor force needs? Secondly, are they good paying jobs? And one of our requirements is they have to be over low to moderate income pay. So, you know, low to moderate income in Delaware County is $39,000 a year for a single person household. So the company has to pay over that in order to tap into any of our incentive programs. And then we then run their job creation and payroll through formulas that then kick out whether, you know, we can give them a certain level of abatement for a certain number of years. And we run that for both the city and the school district. We want to see that the school district's receiving about anywhere from 30 to 40% of what they would have normally received without the incentive package.
Uh-huh.
And that the city also is then seeing at least a 25 to 50% return on investment on that same package.
Do you do this with residential as well as commercial abatement plans?
We haven't started that yet, and that's a very good question. Because the way we use residential is primarily for those distressed properties. We don't.
Oh, okay.
We've
that's
never
right.
ever used it for a new residential construction project. For an example. Really, the main area where you see our residential CRAs being utilized today is in our downtown area or in our surrounding historic neighborhoods. So if there's a house that is incredibly distressed, actually may be condemned, mm-hmm. if it wasn't reinvested upon, we would then grant a community reinvestment area abatement on that structure to help that owner or a new owner to reinvest in it and bring it back up to good living standards.
A 2015 study by Franklin County Auditor Clarence Mingo revealed that developers in Franklin County shifted more than $300 million in tax burden to the rest of taxpayers over the previous 5 years. It sounds like a lot. Greg LeRoy, is it, or is that sort of typical?
I think it's typical. I mean, that's the big picture here. For every deal that is a windfall, and again, black box problem, hard, impossible to determine what share that is, but I think it's a big share, does amount to a burden shift because at the end of the day, there's no such thing as free growth. If you're going to have population growth and job growth and school population growth, you're going to have to hire teachers and widen lanes and pick up trash. None of that's free, so other people's taxes are going to have to go up if the developers don't pay their fair share.
And Mark Partridge, when cities or municipalities or counties or whatever the political subdivision is negotiating these types of things, do they look at the company that's asking for the abatement to see whether there's a financial need for it?
Well, I mean always the economic development, the county or whoever's in charge will say that they're looking at the kind of, how much tax revenue would have been there without it. And they're saying they're making all these considerations. I think the question is that often their incentives are for some short-term hit before the next election, and the cost of these things where the schools don't have enough funding and other governments don't have enough funding to provide public services. People don't see that until several years down the road, and they don't make the connection. So, as part of this is this timing issue of when they want a big hit before the next election.
Because I was doing a show last week, and we were talking about what happened with the corporate, whatever you want to call it, that bought up and started managing Anchor Hacking in Lancaster, and they were raking in millions and millions and millions across the board, but still getting 50,000 or here and these kind of tax abatements in this town that was struggling to keep this company there. Sean Hughes, is the need on the part of the developer taken into consideration?
Yeah, we do look at need, and as the other gentleman said, it's always a definitely a thing that's hard to weigh,
because they tell you what they want to tell you.
Well, exactly. I mean, we can only go by what they put in their application and what we have in conversations. However, what we're trying to really do with our incentive package is to solve a problem. If they say that, your community might be slightly more expensive to do X in, how can we bring that cost down to where we're competitive with another community? And that's really one of the ways that we're utilizing tax abatements and incentive packages. And we also have economic incentive grants that we put on top of our abatements sometimes when they're necessary to say maybe a site didn't have fiber going to it, and that made it non-competitive with another community that their site did. We can help alleviate some of that cost to make us competitive. But, when it comes down to it, we really have to, listen to what the company's saying and try to solve their issues with them and be partners.
Yeah, Mark Partridge?
Well, I think that really, underlies, one of the difficulties is that the company has every incentive not to tell the truth in this. I mean, that you're trying to make as much profit as possible, so they're going to say our costs are really high. You're going to have to give us this great deal. While they go to the next community and say a similar story, and they're really, they're doing what's best for their bottom line, but they're really trying to extort communities and trying to get a deal that by the time they get the winning deal could be very bad for the community, but very good for the company.
Sean Hughes, all things being equal, how much do you know about who you're competing with and what the deals are? Is it just what the city or what the company tells you, or do you communicate with other, political subdivisions that are in play here?
Every project is completely different. Sometimes we know who we're competing against. Oftentimes we don't. Sometimes we see the packages. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes they come from the company. So unfortunately, we're only utilizing information that we're being told. But I think it's important to realize that, going back to a statement I said earlier, we are actually adding money back into the market the way we do incentives. So, we're making sure that 40% of what a company normally would have paid is then going back to the school districts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important to note, because not all communities are doing that. And we actually do have the school districts at the table with us every step of the way so that they understand what this all involves and that they're benefiting just like the city is.
Sean Hughes, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Sean Hughes is the Economic Development Director for the City of Delaware. Also with us, Mark Partridge, Regional Urban Economist at Ohio State University. Thanks to you, Mark.
Thank you, Ann.
And Greg LeRoy, Executive Director of Good Jobs First, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit that tracks public subsidies to corporations. Greg, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time today.
Great to be with you.
That's it today. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.